Schuster bid for Emory University. She was the winner of the National Debate Tournament in 1996 when Giants held field. A former NDT champion and graduate student and teacher, and she's teaching now at the Dartmouth Debate Institute and has offered to come up to show her support for our program, as well as to share with you a few thoughts about the college debate topic. Please welcome Kate Schuster.
Alarm was called up. I walked from Hachibori to the Bank of Hiroshima in Kumayacho. I arrived at the bank sometime around 8:15 or so and signed my name in the attendance book. When I was doing my morning routine, dusting the desks and things like that, the atomic bomb was dropped. All I remember was that I saw something flash suddenly. I lost consciousness right after, or almost at the same time I felt a flash. When I regained consciousness, I found myself in the dark. I heard my friend, Ms. Asami, crying for her mother. The sky first started to grow lighter. We first thought to escape to the parade ground, but we couldn't because there was a huge sheet of fire in front of us. So instead, we squatted down in the street next to a big water pool for fighting fires. Since Hiroshima was completely enveloped in flames, we felt terribly hot and could not breathe well at all. After a while, a whirlpool of fire approached us from the south. It was like a big tornado of fire spreading over the full width of the street. Wherever the fire touched, it burned. I burned my ear and my leg, and I didn't even realize that I burned myself at that moment, but I noticed it later. The whirlpool of fire that was covering the entire street approached us from Okemachi. So everybody just tried so hard to keep away from the fire. It was just like a living hell. After a while, it began to rain. The fire and the smoke made us so thirsty, and there was nothing to drink, no water, and the smoke even disturbed our eyes. As it began to rain, people opened their mouths and turned their faces towards the sky and tried to drink the rain, but it wasn't easy to catch the raindrops in our mouths. It was a black rain with big drops. They were so big that we even felt pain when they dropped onto us. We opened our mouths just like this, as wide as possible, in an effort to quench our thirst. Everybody did the same thing, but it just wasn't enough. Someone found an empty can and held it to catch the rain. I still felt very thirsty, and there was nothing I could do about it. Hiroshima was entirely covered with only three colors. I remember red, black, brown, and something else. Many people in the street were killed almost instantly. The fingertips of those dead bodies caught fire, and the fire gradually spread over their entire bodies from their fingers. A light gray liquid dripped down to their hands, scorching them. I was shocked to know that fingers and bodies could be burned into form like that. I just couldn't believe it. It was horrible, and looking at it, it was more than painful for me to think how the fingers were burned, hands and fingers that would hold babies or turn pages, they just burned away. For a few years after the atomic bomb was dropped, I was terribly afraid of fire. I wasn't even able to get close to fire because all my senses remembered how fearful and horrible the fire was, how hot the blaze was, and how hard it was to breathe the hot air. It was really hard to breathe. Maybe because the fire burned all the oxygen, I don't know. I could not open my eyes enough because of the smoke, which was everywhere. Not only me, but everyone felt the same, and my parts were covered with holes. Welcome to the wonderful world of international relations. As you probably guessed by now, it's not a lot like Disneyland. Or maybe it is. That's the subject of this lecture. Part one, international relations. International relations theory, abbreviated as IR by those people in the know who write about it, does a couple things that I'd like to share with you. A, IR maps. IR maps. First, it creates a language that picks out landmarks that it wants to note on the map. Landmarks like nation states, borders, democracy, fascism, communism, realism, idealism, intervention, sanctions, social science, diplomacy, war, acceptable costs, collateral damages, hard power, soft power, constructive engagement. IRMF got a set of concepts. It also organizes. International relations as a discipline organizes. It uses techniques like problem, solution. Problem, solution. Cause, benefit. Cause, benefit. An advantage, disadvantage. B. The map is not the territory. The map is not the territory. It's not the territory because it always represents the territory. And that's the point of it. The point of it is not, according to the international relations theorists, to make up some fantastic map. The idea is to faithfully present, to represent the territory, the reality out there, the world populated with nation states, democracies, fascisms, and wars, and all that sort of thing, to represent that as faithfully as possible. To represent adequately, of course, one requires things like presence, closure, and fidelity. We want an honest representation. We want a true representation. We want a right representation so we can do the right thing. Because we're a can-do kind of society. International relations has a couple fundamental assumptions. The first one is that international relations theorists assume that the norms of international society are that the national community requires borders and fixed identities. Borders and fixed identities. So you have an identity as a United States citizen, and the United States has borders, and those, of course, are faithfully represented on the map. International relations as a discipline also is built upon recognizing things. Built on recognizing things. Of course, the interesting thing about recognizing things is you're always thinking them again. Right? You're always cognizing and recognizing. Recognizing always thinks again. Remember that. That'll be important later. International relations believes that there can and should be a necessary alignment between a state and a nation, between territories and identities. International relations as a discipline also believes that fundamentally the subject and the object can be separate. The subject and the object are separate. Things act on other things. The United States bombs Japan. There's a subject, there's an object. We are attacked in the War of 1812. Oh, no, wait, we went the other way around. Silly me. Subject, object. Extreme examples, possibly. International relations also believes that the social scientist or the theorist, as a detached observer, produces knowledge which is fundamentally value-free. Just fundamentally value-free. It's just knowledge. Hey, it's just knowledge. I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just saying, hey, I went out in the world. I observed, for example, that a lot of people were killing each other in Bosnia. I just observed that. I just thought I'd point that out for the record. So that's what international relations believe, is that fundamentally they're attached observers who can produce value-free knowledge. That isn't to say that they don't claim to have value, because of course they do. Because for the international relations theorists, there's a big difference between being descriptive and prescriptive. It's a very important division for them. One, you can describe something, according to these people. You can say, well, there's a big problem here, for example, in Bosnia. There's a problem in Bosnia. And a prescription, which would react up that description, would be like, well, we should try to do something about resolving that problem. You know, for example, with the bomb, or we could lift the embargo, or we could do a bunch of different things. So they get all their options out of place, and based on the description, they go ahead and do the prescription. Finally, international relations theory believes that the only thing that's going to count as knowledge, is something that arises from an observation of reality. Something that arises from an observation of reality. And whether that's prescriptive or prescriptive, you can use that. Okay, so now we know a lot of things about international relations. That the map is not the territory, it only represents it. Unfortunately, for international relations, there is a crisis. For the past decade, the Anglo-Saxon discipline of IR has been in a state of flux and turmoil. Everything has come under question. Nothing has remained unchallenged. The railings and bridges of Orthodox IR wisdom have fallen into the water, and numerous attempts to replace them immediately met the same fate. No consensus, No new coherent paradigm is in sight. Ruh-roh. What's IR to do? What's IR to do? It's in chaos. There are all these radical, critical people who are saying things like, you know what? We're sick of the fact that you seem to feel like steps are to organize the world in a fundamentally patriarchal fashion. We're sick of the fact that you continue to justify things like neo-colonialism with your so-called conservative agenda. There are all these crazy people out there trying to tear down the edifice of international relations, and it looks like they're winning. It looks like they're winning. See, the map creates the territory. The map creates the territory. International relations, some of these critics observe, requires fundamentally a kind of colonization. And it requires fundamentally kind of colonization. What do I mean by that? Well, remember I said that international relations has its kind of own vocabulary and it maps the world. Well, what that means is that when you've got a map, you've got a map, my visual aid. I teach public speaking in my spare time, so I can do things like that. So when you've got a map and something comes about that doesn't quite fit onto the map, you know, that doesn't seem to fit onto the map, and it might even call into question the ability of the map to represent in the first place, there's some other thing out here, and you counter the first thing. And the only way that you can make it work for you is to go ahead and fit it into your map. Expand your map out here to be able to explain that. Our maps are like lenses through which we see the world. So, for example, we apply the vocabulary to the world. If you're trained in international relations theory, go with some of the critical authors, when you encounter the world, you go ahead and assume into existence all of the concepts from your discipline. You go ahead and assume into existence the need to think about the world as a set of problems and solutions organized around a community of nation states. You continue to see the world that way when you counter evidence that might suggest otherwise, like the increasing so-called proliferation of non-state actors being relevant in global politics, and the fact that the nation state as a whole is increasingly becoming less relevant in the information age and that sort of thing, at least according to some of these theorists. Then if you continue to believe that, when you encounter that evidence, you'll just find some way to assimilate it within your pre-existing set of assumptions and your existing paradigm. And they say that that's a problem because really what it does is that performs a kind of colonization move. It performs a kind of colonization move because you encounter something that's other and you immediately assign it an identity. You immediately assign it an identity, and the act of assigning that identity within the parlance of international relations does a colonization because it always thinks that identity is necessarily affiliated with things like the nation state. Okay, with things like acting and rational self-interest. In short, identity is assigned to the other, and the other, which doesn't quite fit into your map, is made comprehensible within the terms of your map. So that happens. There's literal colonization, and then there's also probably figurative colonization, which is some of these critical theorists say, that the very possibility of colonialism is generated by the kind of thinking which resolutely insists on mapping the world, which resolutely insists that there is the world outside of the thinking about the world is fundamentally real. In other words, there's a bunch of people out there, crazy lunatics, trying to tear down the discipline of international relations, and what they're saying is, hey, our argument is not your map is the map of the world necessarily. Our argument is that the very process, the way of thinking that enables you to map the world is exactly the kind of thinking which enables you to do all the bad stuff that you condemn. Who are these nutcases? Who are these nutcases? I'll bring some cards on a little bit. So what has IR done to react to this crisis? Well, here's the response. The response by international relations. Remember, they're confronted, their whole discipline is falling down, and in the midst of this disarray, orthodox approaches to IR appear surprisingly resilient, or at least so they present themselves. Many IR scholars who occupy key positions in the Western Academy unwaveringly pursue the same research agenda as before the thawing wind started to blow. They cling to old notions of good and evil knowledge? And why is it the railings and bridges of IR theory were still intact? They reaffirm the realist dilemmas that are allegedly arise from the anarchical character of the international system. They contemplate the roles of regimes and international institutions, or they revisit one more time the issue of absolute versus relative gains. So despite all of the attacks on the method, on the product, on the theory integrity of discipline of international relations, the theory itself, it just continues to sing the same old song and act as if nothing ever happened. Very interesting. Very interesting. The plot thickens. The plot thickens. This is part two of the lecture, and it may appear that it has absolutely nothing to do with the government relation. I'm willing to accept that possibility, that it has nothing to do with any of the rest of the lecture. But guess what? You're cat diamond. Accordion solo. This is the accordion solo of the lecture. Just imagine while I'm talking that there's some dude over here with an accordion just like softly playing. You know, like we're all hanging out at a small intimate restaurant and there happens to be an accordion player. Don't give me polka though. Wait till I'm there. Everybody polka. Alright, I want to tell you a story. I want to tell you a story about a guy named Narcissus. This guy named Narcissus, you may remember him from such films as Ovid's Metamorphoses, because that's not a film, it's actually a really old book, but that's a Philip Hartman movie. You may remember him from such films as Ovid's Metamorphoses. Someone, please tell me what the deal is with Narcissus. Give me the couple second version of the story, yes. Okay. That's what I'm just reading, yeah. What's the term that we all say on a fairly regular basis which calls into existence the sort of specter of narcissism? What's that word? Narcissism. What does it mean when we say that something is narcissistic or someone is narcissistic?
Self-indulgent.
They love themselves, right? Isn't that what we say? God, he's so narcissistic, he looks in the mirror all the time. And he's like, he can't get enough of himself. Okay, so we got narcissism and Narcissus. I want to tell you a story of Narcissus in kind of a slightly different way, and I want to see what that does to our received reading of the story of Narcissus.
That's where I'm going with this.
Okay, so for your consideration, Ovid, renowned mythical legend that he is. Are you right? Please don't let me sign it. Alright. Narcissus, he's walking along in the forest one day, and he's hanging out with some of his friends. He's 16, he's gorgeous, it's spring. And Ovid said all the boys and all the girls were desperately in love with him, but he was just having none of that. He was having none of that. He didn't even hear their pleas. Anyway, he's in the forest, he's hunting deer, and a nymph named Echo finds to see him. You've heard of Echo, right? You know, that's where we get the word Echo. Hello? Are you listening? But Echo has a problem in that the goddess Juno has cursed her, because she talks too much, actually, has cursed her to only be able to repeat the ends of other people's sentences, or to repeat other people's sentences. So she has no voice of her own. The only thing that she can vocalize is repetition. So Echo sees Narcissus and she's just like, oh my god, he's so handsome. And so she chases after him in the forest and she's kind of following him around. And finally, the moment she's been waiting for arrives, and he calls out to his friend, hello. And she answers, hello. And he says, who's there? And she says, who's there? And the dialogue goes on for a little while. And finally, Narcissus, he's like, really wants to figure out what's up with this. And so he says, come, let us meet. In Latin, he uses this, hic nunc coemus, come, let us meet. And Echo says, coemus, let us meet. But the interesting part of that is that coemus, by itself, is a violation. Like,
Grab it by itself basically means, let us have sex. So she says, however, you know, let us have sex. And he's like, oh, no. Forget about it. I don't want to talk to you. I'm never going to let you have power over me. And he bails. And she, grief stricken, and spends the rest of her life wandering around the wilderness, which is why we have Echo, according to myth. Okay, enough about Echo. So, well, Echo will be important in the story later, but. So, Echo wanders west. Narcissus, a bunch of his friends see this little transaction take place, and they're sick of it. One boy in particular is so mad, he's like, screw Narcissus, he's such an asshole, we're all in love with him, and he won't even give us the time of day. So he prays to a goddess, and she says, and he's like, hey, you know, help the cow down here. And she says, all right, cool, I'll take care of it. You know, I curse him. And the boy's like, all right, right on. that's that whole part of the story, and that's the close note to that part of the story. So then, the goddess, basically what happens is Narcissus goes, and he catches much fear, and he gets real tired, he's got to rest, and so he goes into this clearing, and he lays down, and there's a beautiful stream. And something you should know before I tell the end of the story is that when Narcissus was a boy, his mother took him before a prophet named Tiresias. Anyone know? What film might you remember Tiresias from? Ethics. Rex. Yeah, Tiresias, he's the blind prophet in that one too. And so he's, you know, he's the real deal, basically. Like, he's already, you know, over 500 prophets met. So she brings him to Tiresias and she's like, you know, hey, what's going to be the deal with my son? And he looks at Narcissus and he says, he will live a long and healthy life if he does not know himself. If he does not know himself. So Narcissus comes to the creek. He's going to bend down and get a drink of water. And so he kneels down. In the water, he sees the hottest guy ever. Totally the hottest guy ever. He's just like, oh my god, he's so handsome. And so he's sitting there and he's just getting bit by this beautiful man in the water. And he really can't contain himself. Now, the traditional reading of the story says, at that point, he just sort of can't turn away from the reflection. He's fallen in love with himself, and so, you know, he just withers away and dies, basically. And that's why we say narcissism is bad, right? And then why narcissism is bad, that's kind of a narcissistic. And the understanding is that self-indulgence will only lead to doom. Okay? I propose the following counterinterpretation. Narcissus, shown here by this elaborate diagram, hanging out at the stream. Thank you very much. That's your old week. Oh no, not really. In the stream, woo, he sees this other guy. And what the conventional reading would have us believe is that this is Narcissus, and this is Narcissus. And so by falling in love with Narcissus, Narcissus falls in love with himself. The assumption there is that the repetition of Narcissus, which is here, often called the repetition. He says it's the body shadow. He says it's a shadow image of Narcissus, that it's a repetition of him, but it's not him per se. You get that, right? It's not, no one really believes that the dude in the water is Narcissus, except possibly Narcissus, which is to be, you know, to be announced later, basically. But the language that we use to talk about it is that he falls in love with himself. That Narcissus himself is both himself, like the body and the body shadow. Whoa, that totally doesn't make sense. Okay, let me explain it another way. This is an interesting problem because Tiresias, remember, says that he will live a long life if he doesn't know himself. So presumably we're to understand him falling in love, love with the reflection as self-knowledge. Right? Because that's why he kicks it. That self-knowledge kills him. So he knows himself, and the reflection is himself, but it's not at the same time, right? It's not actually himself, is it? It's just a reflection of himself, right? It's just a representation of himself, okay? It's just a representation of himself, but we call it himself, okay? We call it himself. That's the phrase that we use to talk about it, despite the fact that it's obviously not him. So when he loves the reflection, the thing that is not himself but is other to himself,
when he,
like narcissism, or other, everybody get that?
When he loves the other, we say he loves himself. So we take that which is other, and we go ahead and call him himself, and that's what self-knowledge is. That's what self-knowledge is. Our system knows himself, our system knows the other, but we're not going to call it the other, we're going to call it himself. And our system says this himself in the myth. He says, oh, I am he. He looks at the reflection, and you know, he's agonized for like pages and pages and pages, and then finally he's like, oh, I am he. And that is evidence for this temper interpretation, because when he says, I am he, this is the moment of self-knowledge. This is it. This is what Tiresias warned him about. Oh, don't go there. Don't go look into that creek. But he does. And he says, I am he. And that's the first moment that Tiresias has known him, or that Narcissus has known himself in his life. But yet, that self-knowledge always comes at the expense, or at least in this story, comes at the expense, metaphorically speaking, of the pure difference of the other. That the difference of the other is that he can be just thought of as distinguished from I, it's done away with at the moment of the construction of identity. At the moment that the self is known, the other is already colonized. At the moment that identity is constructed, I am me, I know myself, difference is already eradicated. Because what Narcissus is in the story about is not just some guy, you know, who has a crush on some other guy, it happens to be just a reflection in the river. What the story of Narcissus is also about, this reading shows, is that when we engage in that kind of, when we engage in that kind of construction of identity, the moment that identification is possible, difference is already made servient, subservient, the second term, okay? It's not he is I, for example, or we are the same, it's I and he. And that's how we know the self, by the way. And that's my argument about this story. It's the only way that we know identity, the only way that we know identity is through the colonization of difference. Now, I'm not saying here, don't leave this lecture and say, well, can't tell us that identity was bad because it colonizes difference. Okay. Yeah, I was to say, not that authorial TED means anything, but I would probably say, if you asked me if that's what I thought the lecture meant, I'd be like, I don't know about that. So that's not my point is that it's really dangerous. My point is that it's really dangerous. And Narcissus proves this. What happens to Narcissus? He kicks it. Big time. Okay, the goddess, she curses you, you're totally screwed. He sits there, times away, waits away. Finally, you know what happens to him? This is an interesting footnote to the story. He dissolves. He dissolves. He turns into water, and he goes into the river. He goes into the water. He himself becomes the substance of this guy, of he. So himself becomes he again, and he dies. He dies. And they're trying to build him a funeral pyre, and they look on the bank of the river where they thought his body was, and there's just a flower. Hang out there. Pretty shady. Pretty shady. The interesting part about that is what? That he, the very thing that gave him self-knowledge, the very thing that enabled him to be a self, to know himself, was the other, right? That's he. That's how he knew himself. That's how he got to the moment of self-knowledge. But the thing that enabled him to know himself, he was also the mechanism for his undoing. It was also the thing that undid him. Water, right? He colonizes the water, and the water dissolves him. Okay, that's the empty accordion, so. Quick break.
Someone,
you want to sign it? Oh, yeah, no problem. All right, quick. What the hell does that have to do with the topic? What the hell does that have to do with the topic? Well, what that has to do with the topic is a few things. First, back to IR. kind of like Return to Witch Mountain.
That's the high R. We're going back there again. Let's look at what it is that I like to talk about, which is that identity is always already. Always already. You get that, right? That it always and it already does. It's a kind of a constitutive thing. Like, it's not like you say, well, it doesn't because it always already is. So it's kind of a postmodern phrase. Okay, so the idea is that identity always already is built on the dead bones of difference. The two key things you should draw from the story of Directors is one, that identity is always drawn, built on the bones of difference. But that's how it becomes. Second thing is that doesn't mean it kills it. That doesn't mean that difference dies. Identity colonizes difference, but it has to retain the possibility of difference in order to give itself being. For example, red is green. Red and green are different. Right? They each have their own identity. The streets are red, some of you are in green, although it's hard to see, etc. Okay, that guy's hat is definitely green, those streets are red. Right? Green? Definitely. Okay, so I've been hanging out in darkness for the last couple weeks, and then of course this is the big green. So, red and green, we know they're different, and the way that we know that they're different is because of a system of organization that I'm going to call the philosophy of representation. You know, you knew I was going to talk about philosophy somewhere, right? The philosophy of representation. I know you really don't want me to read any more parts of you, but I'm just going to read this one more to explain this. This is by a guy named Michel Foucault, who's an urban legend. Those are 12. You can write that down. Michel Foucault, urban legend. Okay. Foucault said, in the philosophy of representation, the relationship between two things like red and green is merely the highest level of a complex structure. First, you've got a contradiction between red and not red. So red is not red, right? You've got red and not red. That's the first thing that the philosophy of representation does. It defines an identity based on negativity. Okay, so red is different from things that are not red. Okay, so that's the first move. The second move is that it performs like a negative test, which is, it says red is not green. So two, you got red, and then you got green, and those are fundamentally different from each other. The first it divides the thing from all the other things, and then it proceeds to take two things and divide them again. The first thing that happens is that there's an exclusive position of red and green. That's what this group demonstrates. After doing all those positions, the philosophy of representation says, all right, now there's an exclusive difference between red and green. And so, the difference between red and green is employed only to ensure identity. My argument is not that there's not a difference between red and green. Okay, that's another thing you should think of. What I'm saying is that the fact that the difference between red and green is relevant for the philosophy of representation only insofar as it lets us figure out what red and green are. Okay? You see what I'm saying? The fact that there's a difference between red and green, the only reason that that's relevant to the philosophy of representation, really, is to give identity to the things red and green, that are red and green. And this is obviously a, you know, kind of mundane example. You're thinking, well, you know, no shit. Right, red, black, green, got it, move on. Okay, but this becomes relevant to IR in the following way. Because the norms of international society, you'll remember I said earlier, for IR theorists, mean that a national community requires borders and a fixed identity. A national community requires borders and a fixed identity. So the nation state is built on the metaphor of narcissism. The nation state is built on the metaphor of narcissism in a certain sense because what made the identity of a nation state possible is exactly the same move that makes narcissism possible. It's exactly the same move that makes red and green possible. All of this takes place via the colonization of difference. We are not you, okay, you are not us, And, you know, either we'll ostracize you and you can form your own community, or we can get assimilated, and why can't we just all get along? A guy named Campbell says that Bosnia proves that this reform doesn't solve war. He says that the nation state is a metaphor can't really be used as a way to solve war. See, I knew you'd pick up yours when I said solve war. Campbell says that, in fact, the requirement of a fixed national identity is complicit in and necessary for certain types of conflict. You're right. We use the example of Bosnia. And I want to share what it is he says, because I think that you will see, based on this, what it is that I'm kind of talking about. Campbell says that international relations, the IR, the conventional theoretical approaches that use kind of basic concepts of IR, mapping, that language, all that stuff, okay, all the stuff your sovereign theater is going to talk about this year, all the stuff your harm is going to talk about this year, your inherency and your significance, and leave out any other legs to the table, oh yeah, advantages and disadvantages, and core motive, and you know, your link terms, and everything, all the evidence, just about, that will be read this year. Campbell says that those conventional approaches are unable to recognize the way that their own diagnostic procedures, remember problem solution, building the map, their diagnostic procedures, their diagnostic language, that IR, for some reason, is unable to recognize that their own diagnostic procedures involve relations of power that actually bring a particular problematization into being. What he says is that IR, these conventional strategies, work. They're strategies of normalization. That's what he calls them, strategies of normalization. And they normalize why? Because this. They normalize because this, because they're talking about identity. They're identifying people. They're building their map. They're just recognizing the world. They just see the world and then they, you know, kind of perceive it. Kind of perceive it clearly and distinctly, one might say. That's a Descartes joke for those of you who don't get it. You hear my other Descartes joke? Some people already heard this. Descartes walks into a bar. Yeah, I have to tell it over here, it's kind of a requirement, I think, but Descartes walks into a bar and the bartender says, hey buddy, you want a drink? And Descartes says, oh, I think not. Poof, just drink. Alright. So, poof. Okay, so, strategies of normalization occur, and the reason that these are normalizing is because they are identifying, they're engaged in a process of identification, which in some senses, it's not dangerous at all, but it's, you know, kind of normal everyday behavior. In another sense, it might be very dangerous. And Campbell thinks that Bosnia is one example of where it's very, very dangerous. He says these strategies of normalization work on people and place. So it's to compare, differentiate, hierarchize, and homogenize them in ways that map manageable problems. See, I used the map before. You know, they map manageable problems. If there's a problem, oh come on, you all saw it, thank you. And if there's a problem, you all saw it. They got the can-do mentality. They work on people, they map them into manageable problems, amenable to solutions that mostly involve distribution, enclosure, and surveillance. Thus, he says, interestingly enough, in Bosnia, apartheid became the most practical solution. The most practical solution is what works. We'll just get them all and put them all in their little different places, and then they'll have their own nation state. They'll have their own enclaves. Everybody of the same identity will be together, finally. They'll have borders. All right, there won't be, you know, any real important differences. Even though there might be different shades of red, you can put all the red over here and all the green over here, and that'll just, you know, that's the way to solve the problem of people not being able to get along. Campbell says that this means, the fact that this kind of vision would legitimize an approach like apartheid and Bosnia means, which he doesn't think will solve the problem, by the way. He says that this means that these theorists can quote this solution do the violence that they seek to solve. They do the violence that they seek to solve. The things that they say are bad and harm, they do that. They do this. They do exactly, they use exactly the same kind of thinking that allows harm to exist in the first place. The same kind of thinking, the same logic that allows the harm to exist in the first place. Killing. Genocide. We've got an identity. You've got an identity.
We fundamentally believe that we know exactly the true way that the world works, which is that we deserve to live and you don't. Oh, you disagree with that. Well, you don't really fit into our map, so I think the most efficient way to deal with that problem would be to kill you, rather than keep you on. When you think about it, it is. You might have some fundamental ethical objections, but it's definitely the most efficient way to get your enemies out of the way, right? Yeah. Most efficient way to end the war in Japan. Most efficient way to kill the Jews. Most efficient way to kill the Vietnamese. Mystified and utterly frustrated by the enemy's decentered invisibility, the agencies conducting, talking about Vietnam, defeat the war, eventually reacted to the uncanny impasse in the same deviously rationalized way that Lieutenant Callie did. They unleashed overtly and massively the latent racist violence inherent in the liberal, democratic, can-do representation of the American war in Vietnam. It was, to be specific, the subversion of their inscribed assumption of presence, the desire for an expectation of closure, the resolution of the narrative that promised decisive victory that after 1965 broke the full fury of American technology against all the Vietnamese. The saturation of B-52 bombings decimated the Vietnamese landscape and contributed to making the agrarian people of Vietnam a population of urban refugees. The indiscriminate use of herbicides like Agent Orange has defoliated and contaminated vast areas of the earth of Vietnam. The mechanized search and destroy missions and the bracketing of free fire zones have resulted in the undifferentiated destruction of entire villages and untold numbers of villagers, the systematic concealed brutalization and torture of prisoners of war and of those villagers suspected of being Viet Cong that spread terror throughout the Vietnamese populace. Efficient. Can do. There's a problem, but we'll solve it. Campbell says that international relations, conventional approach to international relations theory, are always in the business of recognizing something as other. And whether we say, oh, that's, you know, isn't that cute, that's other, or if we say, oh, I totally respect your otherness, or if I say, well, you know, I really want to work with you on this. I think we have some kind of mutual problems that we can help each other solve. And I'm sorry I haven't invited you into my house before, but here, other, why don't you come into my house and we'll talk? Why don't you come into my house and we'll talk? I've decided I want to constructively engage you. So first you recognize the thing, the other thing is other. But Campbell says the funny thing about that, he says that initial move, that initial recognition of other, which we all know is the founding, that's how we get identity, right, is that we recognize as other. He says that's tied to a misrecognition of the self. Which we're allowed to do because we are enabled, according to the IR authors, these authors that you're going to be reading this year, they don't even think about this stuff. They don't think it's important. You said to them, hey, your identity is contingent. That there's a very real possibility that this, your identity, the identity of things on your map, the identity of your map itself, your very ability to map the world and assume that that world just exists, transparent, present, at hand, for you to just check it out, if you believe that, then that's dangerous because that allows you to overlook how identities are radically contingent. The identities are radically contingent. And our territories are radically contingent. So what? We're being constructive engagement. We don't really have to worry about this. Right? Resolution, doesn't the resolution require you to do a good thing? The right thing? The constructive thing? Hey, by the way, the slideshow is titled. I haven't disclosed it yet, but I guess someone is on some schedule, which is okay. The title of the sweatshirt, well, the topic we're debating is constructive engagement. What does it mean? What does it mean to construct something? Yeah, the bill. And it's not just the bill, right? Isn't it the bill with? Con? Yeah? What? Yeah. We're built together. It's constructive engagement. So there's the building with. And then there's the erecting structure.
Oh, she said erecting.
Yeah, I can't get a lecture without making a picture up here. Oh, God, it's on the internet. All right, so, constructive engagement in the literature is used as a kind of humanizing of international politics, right? The idea being that, well, we've really been basically trying to get our big foreign policy stick and beat people into submission, right? We're not going to send you our economic goods. We're not going to sell you any arms until you straighten up and behave right. You can't go to the movie until you clean up your room. Okay? Just kind of that way of thinking about the world. And people say, well, maybe that's not the best way to think about the world. Maybe we should think about the world as really a bunch of cool other people that we want to try to work with and get things done together. You know, we want to go out and work together and solve some of these other problems. You know, solve some of these other problems and not, you know, try to get them to be just like us. But instead, we have arrangements like collective security. We'll all be secure together. Against who? If we're all secure together, who are we securing ourselves against? And what does it mean when we say we want to constructively engage a country? Doesn't that usually mean that we want to kind of try to get them to affect some change in their behavior? Doesn't it? Isn't that what those authors say? You know, that really the best way to change someone is to work with them. And so instead of trying to beat them, which is obviously coercive, we're not just going to try to persuade them, which is obviously not coercive. That's what's said, right? We say, hey, we're just telling them, we're just trying to persuade them. At least we're not beating them up, and not, it's a lot better. So that thing over there, that was power. That was bad. And our kind of presentation of the need to do constructive engagement, that's truth. That's truth, and that's good. And it's a good thing to go ahead and speak the true way of the world and that false way of the world, which is obviously engendered by power, although what it is that we said is, right, what it is that we said, that was a faithful representation of the world. That 1AC, where we laid out the problem and we laid out the solution, that's not ideological. That's the truth, man. That's the way it is. And we got empirical solvency. You know, and our map really does represent the world. And that other stuff that we solved for, their map didn't represent the world because it was too ideological. Because you see what's going on here, right? It's the thing that's unquestioned fundamentally by that approach is the very possibility of the map representing the world at all. Or more to the point, the possibility that the world, the fundamental assumption that the world just exists there, out there already, waiting for us to apprehend it. You know, like to wonder, oh, there's the world right there. There's a couple of weird things, and I'm not, the reason I call this deconstructive engagement, I call it deconstructive disengagement mostly because I was going to be dissing. Deconstructive engagement, so I thought I'd get that in. But the reason I call this deconstructive engagement is because I just want to lay this on you. It's a pretty heavy philosophical concept, but that thing that I was just talking about, you know, the idea that, hey, wait a minute, maybe there's some way that the map makes the territory. And maybe the territory just isn't out there waiting for us to discover it, but maybe there's something about the way we think about the world which makes the world work that way. It's not to say thinking makes it so, right? $1 million in my bag. No. How about language? There's $1 million in my bag right now. No. That's not my argument. It's that, when we say it, it appears. That only works on, like, eyes and achieving. My argument is that the fundamental assumption of specifically IR theory, but a lot of other theory, is that there's this self, which is here, and then there's this world, which is here, and that world, that's pretty much fully transparent to the self. And the self really only, the relationship only goes this way, right? That we encounter the world, and we say, oh, look, there's the world, how nice. That world exists fundamentally outside of us, and that it is fundamentally transparent to us, that if we just work hard enough, we'll be able to get the truth, which is up here, and we'll be able to know that,
and we'll be able to put it down here, and we'll be able to construct the perfect map of the world. And maybe our map isn't perfect right now, but God damn it, we're working on it. We can do it. We're a can-do kind of society. All we've got to do is try to make our identities as coherent as possible, and that way we'll be able to fully everyone in the world. Well, there's a word for this kind of thinking. It's a logocentrism. So, the reason that I call it deconstructive engagement is because this whole time, this whole hour, I just didn't figure it out. What I was trying to call into question is that there's something about constructiveness that always goes on in international relations. We're already constructively engaged with the world. We're constructing it every day. We constructively engage all the time. We go out and try to figure out what the world is. We construct it. And it's already pre-constructed, too, because our authors did some constructing before we ever got to them. But we're still convinced that there's a reality out there. And by this, of course, I'm not saying that this is not a pen, or there is no pen here, I'm not saying that. Kate Gorman, there was no such thing as reality, in the picture. What I'm saying is that we are constructively engaged all the time, and if you think that constructive engagement is fundamentally different from destructive engagement, because that's the implicit assumption of the resolution, right? That, constructive, as opposed to all that other stuff that was destructive. So the very distinction that I was talking about earlier, remember I was talking about the power that was exercised earlier and the truth that was thinking of that? Right, the destructive engagement, the constructive engagement is trying to get away from, that's the power, that's the backstop. That was the beating over the stick with the stick. And the constructive engagement, that's the good stuff, that's the true stuff. We know better now how to map the world. We've got this all figured out. We can do it. We can solve all these problems. And it may be the fact that they're problematized as problems in the first place is part of the problem. So,